Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet John Clausen, who introduced us to a bear who'd lost his hat, then to a fish who stole a hat, and has brought us one last hat story to share with our friends. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. We are growing at All the Wonders, and I wanted to share an opportunity for you to grow with us. We're interested in bringing someone new onto the team with experience developing social media platforms. While we've managed our social media profiles since launching All the Wonders last October, we are now at a place where it would benefit the site and the team to have one individual strategically growing All the Wonders' presence and voice on social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If this sounds like the right fit for you or someone you know, send us an email at here@allthewonders.com. That's here, H-E-R-E, at allthewonders.com. And now, on to the show. This is episode number 296 of the podcast with John Clausen, author-illustrator of We Found a Hat, the final book in his Hat trilogy. John's journey as an illustrator from This Is Not My Hat until now, even from just the last time he was on this podcast until now, has been full of celebrations and fanfare and awards and recognition on big lists. That's pretty awesome. But what I've really been loving is how, amidst all of that noise, as wonderful as it may be at times, John's returned with what might be his quietest work to date. And it's certainly one that, for me, has left a lasting and warm feeling. Enjoy this time with friends, a hat, and a beautiful sunset. Here's episode number 296 of the podcast with John Clausen. Welcome back to the podcast, John Clausen. I'm glad to have you back.
Oh, I'm very glad to be back. Thanks for having me back.
Of course, John. And congratulations on, at this point, when this comes out, the release of We Found a Hat.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been a long time going. How long have you been working on the trilogy? Like,
I don't even want to think about that. Well, it's been, I think that I looked at, because I didn't know, I don't think it registered that the other two books came out as close to each other as they had. And then I was looking at the copyright dates all in a row the other day, and someone had written something about how one of them came out, I think it was 2011, and then the next one came out 2012, and then it's just like, well, what have I been up to all these years? Like, that's a long gap in between the second and the third one, but I don't know, maybe I took a lot of road trips or something. I'm not sure what happened.
You had to take the journey. You had to find your way.
Yeah. Yeah, I sure did.
I think in between what happened was you were like busy doing Sam and Dave. You were busy doing extra yarn. Like there was some pretty incredible stuff coming out on the in between.
There was some stuff, and there was also a lot of versions of this book, I think. But and there was some novels. I think I started getting into like novel covers and illustrations and stuff. So it hasn't been totally unproductive, but it does. I was still a little bit horrified to see how much time this one has taken to get it right.
Yeah, but my word, in between this, you've done PAX. Holy cow.
Like, oh, yeah.
Everyone's talking about PAX. It's such a great book. And
I feel like I've taken more responsibility for that one than I ought to, though. I did some covers and some interiors. She was all done. It's such a weird thing when a novel comes out and you illustrate it. It's happened in the last two where I did The Nest and PAX, and both of them, I have like credits on the cover and stuff, and it's really nice, and it's such a flattering thing, but it also just feels like, I don't know, I feel like I'm coattail riding a little too hard with those books because they're such singular works, and it's great to be able to sort of design and be on them, but it's not quite the same as a picture book, right? Where you're not quite as in charge of telling the story as you are with a novel. Like it's you're sort of just decorating and making sure that you don't mess up the tone of it. But they have been really fun. It's been great to kind of peek into that whole other world too of middle grade and older books.
Yeah, and I think that it's just fun to illuminate a story with illustrations from a person that we know your body of work so well. So it's kind of nice.
And what's also, I get kind of nostalgic about it too, because I used to read a lot of those kinds of books with like chapter illustrations and stuff, and you sort of remember those weird moments that they picked out to decide to illustrate, and you sort of flip ahead to see what the other illustrations were going to be. It's neat to sort of get into that, and it's different because it's black and white, and you're usually just using graphite, so it's a simpler, it's not as stressful an illustration process. It's fun to change gears a little bit.
I love the notion that, like, by full admission, you used to leaf through and look at the illustrations of the middle grade books, as I think we all must have. But then you're in it making those exact things. You should have left little notes to the readers like, no, really, go back. This picture will still be here waiting for you.
Yeah. I think it's funny, though, too, because I associate it with, like, pulpier books. Like, I guess maybe that's the wrong word, but I used to read, like, a ton of, like, Hardy Boys and stuff. And it really teaches you, like, even those books, how they were presented, the covers and the titles and then the illustrations themselves. It kind of teaches you about how to put those books together. Like we were talking about the other day, how like the titles of Hardy Boys books almost never connected too hard to the stories themselves. And like, you're wondering like, when did we get to this like secret cliff, you know, thief cave or something. And they get there like for a minute, but it's not the actual story. And you don't even mind by then because you just sort of like the cover. And the same with the illustrations where you're looking ahead. You're like, what is this like miner doing in this cave? And like, what's going on? And it's just sort of, it's not at all what you thought it was going to be after you looked at the illustration and got to the book. But it's neat that they sort of string together these really poppy moments to sort of get you in.
Right. Well, we've come away, haven't we?
I still like them, but yeah, I hope
no,
so.
No, yeah, I think that, I can't even imagine if they're doing something exactly like that. It's not an experience that our children get to read unless they're reading those older books. They just don't. There's not really anything. Publishing has moved, as you're showing, in a different direction. That it's a little more intentional illustrations. But then again, you're not writing books with that serial focus that Hardy Boys was.
Yeah, I guess not. It's almost a shame, though, because I really did like them.
So many people read and devoured those. It was, you know, you needed the next book to read, and here was a series that was so reliable. Well, but let me just point out, though, that the Hardy Boys...
Yeah, you really didn't mind.
The Hardy Boys, though, never had a... What was the thing the publisher was handing out at AASL for PAX? The pop-out diorama thing.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Imagine living in a world for Hardy Boys like that. That's amazing.
That was really fun to make, that thing.
I'm sure it was. It reminded me of... when you're... perhaps you've done this. I mean, you must have had the opportunity to do this. I've seen from past Caldecott, from the past award receptions, that often the winner of the Caldecott will design sort of a card or a something that is at the table of the people that attend the banquet. I've seen it for for Chris Roschka in particular. I remember seeing Chris Roschka's for A Ball for Daisy.
Yeah, I remember that one too. That was the first Caldecott dinner I went to, and I got to see that thing. I didn't know they did that until I saw his, and that was really neat. I got to do one. We did one for This Is Not My Hat that year, but it was that was such a crazy year, and I was on tour a lot. We did a really nice one. My art director put it together at Candlewick, and Stott put it together. It's this really great kind of understated. We used a lot of vellum and like layered printing. It was really fun to put that together because it's so neat because, you know, like all your friends at the dinner are going to get one and they get to see this thing. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's a special moment. Well, back to the the thing that everyone else is going to get to see. We found out how it is coming out, and it has been a couple of years coming, but my goodness, the way that you... So I was saying to you off recording that when we last talked, you sort of had questions about how this story was going to work itself out. You were still sort of, as you do, wrestling with the story, figuring out what's the best way to tell it. But the angle you take, John, is so... It's such a right turn from the other two books, and yet it's so perfect as the end of a trilogy.
I'm glad you
executed it well. I really like it a whole lot.
I remember I listened to that podcast again not too long ago to sort of prep for this one or sort of remind myself sort of how this goes. And I think I said something like, I wanted it to be like a quieter one, but I was insecure and like sort of wondering if anybody wanted that from the series. I didn't even know how to write it. But I think we did get kind of a quieter one with this one. And it does feel not too far off tonally from what I think I was hoping for in that last one.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to let you share a little bit about what goes on in the story, but then I do want to jump back to the work you have going on in the undertones of this story that I think works so well. Could you first share, John, though, just for the people that are about to discover this book, a little bit about what goes on in We Found a Hat?
Yeah, well, the book, this one is a little bit longer, and I split it up into sort of three parts. And the first part is entitled Finding the Hat, and it's these two turtles who right away, like, you know, are sitting on the page with this hat between them that they found, this cowboy hat, and they sort of talk to the audience, and they say, we found this hat together, and we don't really know what to do, because obviously there's one hat and there's two of us. And then they sort of debate it philosophically almost, where they've come to the conclusion that's like, it's not morally right for, you know, or at least we can't figure this out. Obviously not one of us can have a hat and the other can't. They don't get into it in terms of like how friendly they are with each other. I had a couple of versions where it was, they were friends. And so they were saying something like, I don't want to have a hat if you can't have a hat. But that didn't seem right because we haven't really established that these guys are friends yet. It didn't really, I hadn't earned that sort of line yet. And so they make it much more impersonal. They say, obviously, it wouldn't be right, just generally, for one person to have a hat and the other not to have a hat. So we have to leave it here. We have to forget about it. We just have to keep moving and not take this hat with us. And one turtle is sort of more on board with this idea than the other one. And he gives the hat sort of a long last look before the end of part one. And then part two has them sort of watching a sunset and what looks like to be sort of a whole new sort of activity, only the other one is sort of still preoccupied with this hat, as we can see sort of off screen. And then the third part is them going to sleep, not too far from the hat again, but this other preoccupied turtle has sort of decided he's going to sneak off at night, and he's asking the other turtle if he's asleep, and sort of, is he almost asleep, and is he all the way asleep, and sort of sneaking off to get this hat. While the other one is asleep, and the other one is sort of talking in his sleep and explaining that he is asleep, but he's dreaming a dream. And the thieving turtle, as he would now be called, is sort of, he's trying to keep him going, trying to keep him talking as he's sort of sneaking towards this hat. So he says, well, what are you dreaming about? And the sleeping turtle explains that he's dreaming about this hat that they've found that day and that he's wearing it. And he's sort of floating in these stars in the illustration sort of to go along with the description of it. And he also explains that in this dream, the other turtle is there too, and they both have hats now in this dream. And they both have identical hats, and they're both wearing them, and it's really great. And it kind of cuts back to the turtle who's just about to, you know, steal this hat in the night, and he feels awful. And he kind of asks the question, like, we both have hats. And then he goes back and kind of takes a look at the sleeping turtle, who is still very much asleep, but now has stopped talking about his dream. He's probably just faded off into the dream completely. Yeah. And then he goes to sleep. The one that's awake finally joins him and goes to sleep. And the last page is the two of them sort of swimming off in these kind of dream stars, both wearing hats and floating away. And that's the end of the book.
I love in the second part to play at that, the, you know, in your other two, for those, maybe just to preface it for the people that haven't discovered it yet, 'cause there's always new people discovering these books, which is sort of the beautiful thing about picture books, isn't it?
Yeah.
But in I Want My Hat Back, you've got you're dealing with this like anger of theft. Someone has stole something from me and they're obviously lying to me. It's time for retribution. And then in the second story, and This Is Not My Hat, It's stealing out of spite. I'm taking this. It doesn't look good on you anyway. It looks better on me. I'm doing you the favor. I'm taking it. And you'll never catch me. But in this story, the feeling, the way you've looked at, to deduce it this much, to look at jealousy in this third way of, I have some connection with the person that has this item that we both covet. Whereas before it was just, you're a stranger, you took it from me, and then it was, you don't deserve it anyway. Now it's, well, I'm sort of with this companion, and my companion really seems to be thinking selflessly, but how do I handle my own feelings of not wanting to do that? And so I want to read to you, if you don't mind, part two, because it's your shortest section. But what you do here with your control of words, John, and not having it play too much into what, you know, great friends they are. They haven't, as you said, earned that line, but just sort of the blocking that you've done with the characters is so beautiful. So I'm going to try to describe it as I go. So this is, do you mind that I read Watching the Sunset?
No, not at all.
Cool. So here we are, Watching the Sunset, part two. We are watching the sunset. We are watching it together. What are you thinking about? I'm thinking about the sunset. What are you thinking about? Nothing. And on said spread, we've pulled, the camera has sort of pulled all the way back to showing the second turtle's eyes gazing back at this hat. And I love that you have the first turtle. The camera's already moved away from that first turtle. We're not even, in that sense, thinking about that first turtle. We're thinking about the hat and that blocking you've done here. It's beautiful, and it's cinematic, and it's really solid storytelling.
Oh, thanks. I'm really proud of that chapter. I think it's my favorite part of any of the three books is that second chapter, because it's like you said, we haven't really earned the relationship yet, and this chapter doesn't really advance the action. We sort of know by the end of part one that this little turtle is sort of, he's not quite sold on the idea of forgetting about the hat. So it doesn't really, I mean, it cements that point further, but it doesn't really tell us anything we don't know already. What I needed to do with it was get them, explain to the audience the relationship further. We needed to raise the stakes of this thing. The problem has been presented already. We open with that. And so the job of this second part is to raise the stakes for the audience so that we really think something's at stake. And showing these two guys watching the sunset, that's something that, you know, strangers wouldn't do together. Obviously, these guys are pretty inseparable, or at least they do this all the time. And even the question sort of, what are you thinking about? That's a very intimate question. You don't ask that of a turtle you just met or something. You ask it of someone you're really close to. And
you don't ask that of a turtle you've just met. I like
your line. You know, if you're a turtle,
there you go.
I just get the feeling that, and I also just like too that I read a review a little while ago. I can't remember who it was, but they said that I didn't do it right. And I was really concerned with this being communicated poorly. But I really think that the one turtle who does say he's thinking about the sunset is telling the truth. I think he's moved on in his head, or at least, you know, consciously, he really is thinking about the sunset. And the other one is preoccupied with the hat. But I think that that page where he asks him, what are you thinking about? And he says, I'm thinking about the sunset. I don't know why I thought I had to zoom in there, because he's thinking about the sunset. You should show the sunset. But for some reason, that page is my favorite page of the book, too, is the close-up on the two of them and sort of them asking each other, what are you thinking about? I'm thinking about the sunset. I don't know why. Their expressions aren't especially complicated or anything, but for me, it's the nicest moment in the book. I like it best.
And you have the background just fading, the pink fading
it's
into the
starting
that,
to get
blue,
darker.
Gray, and, I think that...
Yeah, and
you call it raising the stakes, which it absolutely is. But in this chapter two, this is where you connect with the reader. This is the universality part, where it's, here's a feeling that I felt before, that I see myself in this event. And I think also, and I haven't read the review, and we all have different opinions, because picture books reflect back yourself, right? They're mirrors and windows. But when I read that, I thought of the duality of the situation, that you can absolutely be thinking about the sunset in the moment with your friend, with your partner, with your comrade, because there is a special thing to sharing a sunset. Sunsets are these things that are fleeting. We don't always see them. And so it's nice to take that moment, but there's also distraction. And so I think it's okay that those two things can exist at the same time. The feeling that you play on over and over of wanting to be there for your friend and wanting to do the right thing, but that sometimes other things just call us so loudly. I think
really that's truthful. That's one of the parts I kind of got surprised with in that section. And maybe one of the reasons I like that section so much is because I find myself sort of, if I examine it a little bit, I'm a little jealous of the turtle who is thinking about the sunset straightforwardly, because you're so often, like you say, watching the sunset, but you're sort of also preoccupied with something else. You've got this calm sunset in front of you and you're working on something else. You're thinking about somebody or something else that you're working through. And it's always sort of this background thing. But wouldn't it be so great to have a clear enough head to just think about the sunset as you're watching it? That sounds amazing to me. And I think that this turtle behind him is sort of, he's kind of wishing that was the case too. He wants to shake this other thing. And here he's got this friend who has done it, apparently. And he's managed to sort of move on that quickly. And he's able to live in the moment and sort of focus on this sunset and sort of just watch it go down. And that fills his head enough. But he's working on something else and it's stressing him out. And his whole thing kind of darkens. And that's why that sunset kind of is important too, is because the last page where he is, or the last page of that section where he says, oh, I'm not thinking about anything, but he's looking at the hat. The sun has gone down. And it's all dark around him now, and he's sort of, his eyes are a little bit glowing in the sort of the dusk, and he's, you know, he's darkened his whole mood. He's darkened himself, stealing himself for this thing he knows he now wants to do in the night. I like that section so much. It, like I say, it doesn't really advance the action very much, so I'm not sure. I'm interested to see how it goes over with kids, because they usually, you know, you want to provide them with some movement, and this one doesn't have very much of it, but hopefully it works.
It's also one of the moments that you do that same technique that you did in This Is Not My Hat, where you sort of betray the words betray the illustrations, is the way I'm trying to say it. That this whole story is sort of about our words betraying our actions, but it's just so quiet. It is like you nailed it with this, but it's so, I feel like this is also then the most piercing, because it feels the most like, I would never steal something. I would never vindictively take something from somebody, but I would absolutely covet something that my friend has or that I wanted.
Yeah, I think that was the reason I was interested in this one when I finally kind of figured it out. It was like, well, now we have the challenge of actually like building a relationship, but the other ones don't really have that. They're sort of about, they're funny, I think. They're funnier than this one might be. But they're also about relative strangers. They're about these sort of archetypal characters who may or may not know each other, and, you know, they steal things from each other. And of course, when someone steals something from you, you want revenge or you want it back. And so it's very impersonal. But with this one, it was important. It wasn't going to work if you didn't believe that these two guys were close to each other. What do you care if strangers are never going to see each other again and they just steal something they found? The whole thing rested on sort of pulling off affection, or that you portrayed it without being saccharine, without sort of being like telling the audience, these two guys are best friends. Like, they don't start the book saying, we are friends and we found a hat, because that doesn't establish anything. We don't believe that. And so you have to earn it over the course of like, you know, two chapters until they come to the end, when you hopefully you've built these two guys up enough, and, you know, the vast 16 pages you've had to do it or whatever it is you get. And that's going to be whether it works or not is whether the book succeeds or not.
So you talked earlier about how you went through several drafts to get to here. And I hear you saying that much of it might have been struggling primarily with how do you establish that they have a connection without beating it over the reader's head, right?
Yeah, I think I came to it kind of by accident, because it was a weird, twisty road to get to this final draft. It was a lot of different kind of stories, and they weren't working, and I couldn't figure out why they weren't working, and I kept submitting them to sort of to my publisher, and they kept pointing out things that weren't working in them. And then they wanted, I had submitted a collection of three short stories that were going to go in one picture book. And the last story in this collection, the stories were about the turtle from the first book and the crab from the second one. And they were these two characters who were going to be in this book. And they were going to have three kind of dumb short stories between them. And that was going to be the third book, was these two kind of side characters messing around with sort of lower stakes stories. Only the third story was at night. The three stories took place the same way as they do with the turtle book now, one during the day, one during a sunset, and one at night. But the nighttime story was sort of, we found a hat condensed into a very short bit of action. And the publisher saw this and didn't quite get what I was going for and said, well, what about this third story, though? The third story really works. But I said, no, the third story only works because they're friends by then. We've shown them hanging out for two stories already that aren't connected to this, but that they're important to show that these two guys, to kind of establish a rapport, some sort of relationship, so that that third story can have any meaning at all. If it's just these two strangers, like I say, we haven't really earned anything. And they said, well, is there any way you can expand this so that you can get a whole book out of this third story? And I thought, well, no, you can't. I have to show them. How do I show them just hanging out? And the first draft of the one where I tried to expand it was like two chapters of them just sort of wandering through the desert, trying to establish a relationship before they find the hat. I said, well, we can't do that. No one knows where we're going for the first section. We have to start with them finding the hat. So that's why that sunset section comes in the middle now. You establish the conflict. You show the problem right away. We found a hat. And then for some reason in the second part, that's why it's about the relationship, because that has to happen somewhere. And it can't happen at the end, and it can't happen at the very beginning, because that's just boring. So you put it in the middle. It was a really weird, like, by the time I finished that, I was like, is anybody going to get this? Because it was such a strange, you know, wandering around trying to get this story. And by the end of that, I was like, I'm not sure anyone's going to have followed me here. Like, maybe I just solved a problem no one cared to solve. Like, I'm just solving my weird, like, last 8 months of story wandering, and no one's going to understand what I've done. But I think the more I got sort of used to tuning it up, it started to work on its own. At least I hope so. But it was a much more random journey to get there than the other ones were. I was worried about that. But yeah, I think I like it the best because of that wandering journey. I hadn't really done one like that before. And to come out of the desert, so to speak, with something cohesive.
Yeah,
it's
right?
Nice to finally have it done. Yeah, it's really
there's
weird.
There's a lot of like symbolism that goes on. I thought, and I know everything is intentional, right? But I know that also when a book comes out that, and other people start to read it, that there are times that readers see things that will come back to you and allow you to see maybe what was happening at a subconscious level as you were designing your book, right? But one of the things I loved that I know actually was intentional was that your two characters are talking and there's dialogue that's exchanged, but yet you come back to we all the time, and you never really denote said the first turtle, said the second turtle. The text on the page is just shared.
Yeah.
All the way to how does it look on me? It looks good on you. How does it look on me? It looks good on you too. But I think in using a shared voice as the narration, because it feels like a shared voice in the narration, and feels like we can't delineate from where one character is talking and where the other is, I think that as well contributes strongly to knowing that there's something between these two that we can trust, that we know is okay.
Yeah, I tried to work as hard as I could to sort of give them as much relationship as we could get before the book even starts. And so that's sort of why it's not a turtle and a crab anymore. Also, I liked the turtle and the crab together. It's kind of funny that these two side players ended up being main characters in this third book, but it didn't really work on its own. If you hadn't seen the other books, the crab isn't really a clear, like, what is he doing outside in the desert? And like, what is he even? It's hard to know. Like, is he an alien? What's going on? And if you show two turtles, you kind of believe they might be brothers, or they might have hung out, you know, when they were little or something. And if they're identical, that makes it even better, because now we don't really know who we're rooting for. And you kind of believe the we speak a little bit more. You kind of believe they might have the same kind of voice when they're speaking together or something. And it's easier to kind of picture this Tweedledee Tweedledum kind of pair wandering around in the desert. And it's just, it makes for a nice symmetrical design, if nothing else. It's fun to illustrate these two turtles facing each other all the time. But yeah, that was important though too. I liked in the first book, and I want my hat back, the whole point of the design was that these characters have colored text that correspond to their colors, right?
Yeah.
That's how you know who's talking. And in the second one, you didn't need to know who was talking design-wise because it was always the one person. But in this one, it was kind of a subtler trick. It's not as clear. And I'm not sure I even want people to notice that we haven't denoted who's talking. Hopefully it's clear enough that you kind of read it instinctively and you don't really notice that we haven't given a turtle a color of green or something like that so we know which turtle is talking. It was neat to sort of design the book and write it so that we can be clear without saying said turtle one or said turtle two or said dark green turtle or said light green turtle. But we had to work really hard at that. There was a lot of stuff to iron out to make sure the audience was going to know who was talking and how. And once you get to know them, of course, one turtle would say one thing and one turtle would say another thing. And so you begin to kind of use that. But I think it's not as clear a trick, but I liked it for that. I think a lot of things about this book are quieter and they aren't sort of as clever, but I think it's maybe using a lot of the lessons I learned from the other two in sort of a quieter way to kind of get this thing across. At least I hope so.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, again, I nod to you for when you use we, it pulls it together. I mean, you're right. I mean, it's very clear as you develop the characters, who has what intention in the story, but just every time you come back to we, there's a one voice here. When you write your manuscripts, John, do you find that you write a lot and have to edit down, or do you tend to think pretty sparsely as well? Because your illustrations are always one thing I admire about your illustrations is how well edited down they are. Your compositions are really clean and often just are tightly focused on characters.
Yeah, I think that it's the same approach with the writing, and that might be out of nervousness because I'm not, you know, a very confident, I'm never going to be a confident writer, I don't think, but I sort of liken it to like a sniper or something where you spend 4 days preparing the site where you would snipe from, and like you watch your prey's route every day as he goes to the grocery store or something, and then finally one day you take the shot and you have like one bullet to do it, and if you miss he's gonna know. And so it's that kind of thing where it's like you prepare and you prepare and you prepare, and then finally you get the guts to sit down at your laptop and type the one sentence, and if it works it works, and if it doesn't then you just go back to bed. I don't have
a lot of... That's amazing. That is not at all where I thought you were going to go. I was picturing like, oh yeah, John Clausen, he's like a quieter guy. And so it just happens that, yeah, I've always been the quiet guy that when I don't speak much, but when I do, it just is something I've really thought about. But
No, it's
more like... You're a sniper. I take the shot and hopefully I make my mark.
And it really is the other thing too, is if it misses, I can't figure out, like I'm still not as confident a writer where if I miss, I feel like, well, that was my shot. Like that's the only shot I'm going to get. I don't have the bravery to go back in there and do like a post-mortem to figure out like, well, how can I do it again? Like maybe I should go back again and fix something. Like I feel like I used it. It has to work this way or else I have to go back to bed. And like, you'll do the sentence and you're like, oh, if it doesn't work, then I'm a crappy writer today. Or I always was, or this whole, like you just, the whole world falls on top of you. And when the sentence doesn't work that you've been pairing, but it's almost like a performance. You write it out and it's like, oh, I didn't stick the landing. I don't get the medal this 4 years or whatever. You know what I mean? Like it's like an Olympic thing. I don't know why. It's just that for me, like I don't expect anybody else to read it that way, but it's writing is still such a weird, precarious thing that I feel like I'm holding a bomb or something. And if I get it wrong, I've clipped the wrong wire and it's all going to go off in my hand. And so it still feels that way I'm getting a little looser at it. This book, I think that weird meandering, wandering in the desert process taught me a little bit to trust that I can wander and still come out of it with something. Whereas before, I think with the other books, it was more like, if I don't prep for this and make it like a sniper shot, like I was talking about, no amount of process on my part, like with the drawing or the writing and actually executing it, is going to save it if I don't prepare like crazy. And with this one, either by necessity or whatever it was, I sort of learned to trust the making of it a little bit more. Like the creation of it has some value in it too. I should watch what's going on while I'm making it because it might be trying to tell me something. And that's, I'd never had that before. I don't think I ever experienced that. And it's exciting because that's a whole new way of looking at it. And I think it feels like something I can use in other things, but I don't really know how yet. But I learned a lot on this one. It was really, for however long it took to get the darn thing done. I think I did come away with at least a couple of things that I'm excited to try out on other projects.
I love it. And you've got other stuff you're working on. I saw recently in PW, it must have been, that maybe it was some of your art that you had done earlier, that Mac Barnett is going to do, where you're writing some stories, three board books, maybe?
They're not board books. They're gonna have board covers. We're doing something with the design of it where they're gonna have like these board covers, and it's gonna be paper pages, but they're three books about these three shaped characters that we're fooling around with, and they're super fun. And it was really nice too.
They're a little bit longer too, then that'll be great.
No, they're like I think the first one is something close to 40 pages. They're regular picture book length.
I mean, as opposed to I'm picturing like a board book sometimes is a little bit shorter anyway. So nice that it's a full length story. I'm picturing like something like press here that has like that cardboard kind of cover.
It has the aesthetic of that. Like we wanted it reads very quickly. Like it's only like one line per page most of the time. A couple pages are a little longer, but it does feel like we kind of wrote a younger one, but also we just, the story just needed, you know, however many pages it took, but it does feel like the staging of it is a little younger and it's about shapes. And so everything, it looks a little primary. But it was so much fun. It got done much quicker than other books I've worked on, but after the turtle book was over, I just felt like this weight was off my shoulders, and it was super nice to just go in there and do something really loose, and we had a lot of fun with it because it was this really great summer that I'd finished this other thing, and I didn't have to worry about it anymore.
I'm just gonna draw triangles and circles.
Honestly, it was like therapy. It was so much fun because it was just like like when you have that kind of constraint, it's so much easier to kind of get going because it's like, well, I don't have an infinity of shapes to choose from. I have squares and triangles. And so knowing that going in, it loosens you up having such strict rules. Do you know what I mean? Like as soon as you start, you're like, well, I know I can't do anything. I have to work with this. And so then you start to get creative, and then you start to sort of bounce against those rules instead of thinking, well, I could do anything. What can I do? And that's just hell. You can't even start when that's your circumstance.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, absolutely. Putting the constraints on it, we tend to flourish when we have, you know, time limits running or things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, so what else are you working on beyond that? Do you have things that you're authoring as well that you started working on yet?
I'm slowly trying to figure it out. It's a bit of a scary thing right now because as much as I really wanted to get that third book done, the third hat book, I wasn't. You know, there is a constraint to those too. If you know that they have to be about hats and they have to sound a certain way and be about animals, probably those are rules and constraints that you can get creative with. And you start with something, so some known quantity with that. And now that they're done, I'm back to that hellish sort of infinity of possibilities as far as what the next book could be about and how to start it. And but I have a couple ideas of some different formats. I think you just have to kind of change your rules and make sure you get some rules down, and so I'm trying that first and seeing what possibilities. There's nothing to sort of announce yet, but I think it's a really fun time because it could be anything, but it's also a really scary time because it could be anything.
Because it could be anything. Yeah. Well, whatever happens, I mean, have fun on that journey. I've enjoyed the past however, what was it, 2 years or something since last talking to you, knowing that you've been on this journey and you struggled, but I mean, you came out with this really beautiful thing on the other side.
I'm so glad you like it. Thank you. It's a scary thing because I think I really like the book that came out, but it's the more you like it, the more you're nervous about how it's going to go over because you're like, oh man, I really wandered away from the herd on this one. And it's been a while, right? So maybe you went crazy in the interim and no one's going to like this one. I don't know. I think the more you like the thing, the more nervous you get about putting it out. It's a weird
John. You sound like an author over here, being all self-conscious of your work. I think you're exactly.
I've been in the cave for too long. I haven't been outside enough. Yeah.
Well, you're about to though. You're gonna get it. Are you going out on tour for this? For We Found a Hat?
Yeah. I'm going on tour. Actually, we get a couple dates. I get to do a couple dates with Carson Ellis. Me and her have books coming out with Candlewick at the same time, and she's got that beautiful book.
Duis Talk isn't out yet, is it? It's coming out around the same time. Oh man, two are gonna have a blast.
Yeah, we get to go on tour. Yeah, that's. I mean, just being around that book is going to be so much fun. I admire that book so much.
Have you met each other before?
Oh yeah, we're pretty good pals. We actually worked together quite a bit on these two books. We sort of passed them back and forth. But I've always, like, since college, it's kind of strange to talk into Carson still because we'll talk and we're pretty familiar with each other by now, and so we can get into some stuff. And then every now and then, I'm like, I had Carson stuff on my bulletin board when I was like in first year of college, and like that's a strange thing to know.
because I think that a lot of my stuff still, like Extra Yarn, I still think owes a lot to Carson. It's like those illustrations, if you look at her older stuff, the sepia tones and just the negative space and everything, still kind of look like her stuff. I feel like, and a lot of her, you know, a lot of contemporary illustrators, I think, owe a lot to Carson. And she kind of just bumbles along, you know, thinking, well, we're all doing books and isn't this nice? But I think we're like, she's kind of the queen of everybody and no one, like, she doesn't really know it.
Oh, that's so, what a cool compliment for her to say. What cool words. I'm sure you tell her that to her face all the time, but I think about
it. We try, but she just kind of turns red and runs away.
Well, she's going to have a lot of turning red and running away when the world sees Duis talk. The way that plays.
Oh, man, it's such a knockout. And, have you seen it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, I've lived with that for a little while. Much like with We Found a Hat, to the extent that it was hard to remember when it was coming out because I've had a chance to sort of live in it and let it marinate and be thinking about it. Duis talk. I feel like I've gone back and gone back and gone back to those illustrations. And much like with We Found a Hat, I'd love to lay all of your interiors out on We Found a Hat. Likewise with hers, because you both have a passage of time, and I just feel like to leaf through We Found a Hat, I love seeing the colors just change. I mean, you're emulating the setting sun, and likewise with hers, you're emulating the passing time as well. And it's
yeah, that idea crazy. Of like a stage, instead of sort of moving through a lot of different spaces, the idea that you sort of the curtain's gone up on this one stage that you have to work with.
Good call. It's really, that's a great way to call it. Yeah.
She really nails it, though, because I don't think her angle changes once the whole book. You're just watching the same composition. It's like a really ballsy move. Like, I had to, you know, move the camera a little bit to get, and like, I zoom in a little bit. It's a bit more, like, I don't think I had the confidence to just hold the shot the whole time. But man, she really went for it. It's a powerhouse of a book.
She's got the great perspective, too, though, of like, it's bugs. So it's like we're on our hands and knees just staring at what's going on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. it's great. I remember, because even when she had the text, it's really funny because when she had the text going, I read the thing and it was like watching, because I love Home. Home is such a cool book and it's so beautifully done. Mm. But Duis Talk felt like someone who like opened a door that no one else had the key to or something. It was like only Carson could have come up with this. And it really felt like she found this diamond inside herself. And I was so excited right away. And like, just the book is gorgeous. You can't, like, there's just no messing with her illustration wise her execution is just flawless, and it's so great because she doesn't know, Carson doesn't really mess with computers all that much. She still does everything by hand, and so none of this, like, it could have easily been this like repetitive sort of thing where she cut and pasted the same thing and that might have been a bit of a bummer, but she didn't. She painted every single one of those things like every time. It's such an admirable piece of work. It's fascinating. I can't get enough of that book.
Yeah, well, we shall have to meet again on the podcast, John, for the third time, and we can start our Carson Ellis talk. It'll be great.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I have a feeling like we could start a podcast about Carson Ellis, and we would not run out of things to say. But
I would never tell her about it, but yeah, it'd be fun to do.
But what a great time to be living in, right, to have these contemporaries that you're working alongside making just beautiful, beautiful things, and still pushing the format forward and showing new ways to tell a story, ways that we haven't seen yet. It's great. So congratulations. That means to you as well. You've really done a beautiful thing. And I love really to see three picture books work together the way that yours do, to play on a theme the way that yours do. You've done an exceptional job, John, and I know you feel proud about it, but I'm excited for all of us to have a chance once again to, pour that love out for the beautiful book that you're sharing.
Oh, I thanks so much for the support all the way along. It feels like it's I don't know. It's nice to know that it kind of connects. And it is, you do these things in your little room by yourself, but you do have everybody in mind when you're doing it. It's really cool to send it out and get a reception. It's really flattering. Thanks a lot.
Well, speaking of all those people that you have in mind in your studio, I want to end with giving you the final say and bringing it back to the children that will soon be reading this book and will soon be responding to it. So, John, I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning. What message would you, and this could be universal, you know, but what message would you like for me to bring the kids from you?
This was a tough one. I'm not, it's so tough because the kids are already in such a good place when they're in the library, but I think that you can you can kind of tell them that they're going to remember these books for a lot longer than they think. And the memories of those books are going to be just as important when they're older as they are now. Like, you will remember these when you're adults. I don't think that kids think that. I never did. That you sort of, you're going to be a different person when you're an adult and these things aren't going to come up. But they are going to remember those books for always, and that those memories of them will be just as important as anything else to them.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love, and the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Drew Wang talks about the creepy case files of Margot Malou, his new graphic novel from First Second, one that I love a whole lot. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.